All right, guys, on today's episode of the Trade Busters podcast, I'm really excited to have Wes Gray with me. He is the CEO and founder of Alpha Architect. You guys, if you haven't heard that name, you may know one of their products, which is the Box BOXX ETF, which has been kind of very popular lately on the top of everyone's minds. And so glad to have Wes on here to kind of chat about it and kind of dig into it and get some, some questions from our viewers. Yeah, Wes, thanks for taking some time. I know you've been busy with going around and sharing about Box lately.
Yeah, of course. Appreciate you having me on, David.
Yeah, and before we go in, I wanted to. You may not remember, but I had been actually referred to earlier. This is a couple of years, maybe more ago, by Corey Hofstein, because I run a couple of options-based funds now. But there was a time when I was interested in learning about potentially ETFs and how that worked, and he had referred me to a couple of people. One of them was you. So I don't know if you remember, but I emailed or DM'd or something. We had like a hour-long conversation. You were like driving or something. I don't know. Again, you literally may not remember. I'm sure you talked to a lot of people, but I just want to, it's a testament to how generous you are with your time. So I wanted to say thank you for taking that time, all those, all that time ago, and once again doing it today.
Yeah, no, of course. I do not recall that particular conversation, but especially if it was on in the car. But yeah, I'm always here for addressing questions and power investors for education. And if anyone wants to talk ETFs or anything about ETFs, I'm always available.
Yeah, and one thing for you guys who haven't done so, I would listen to you were on the Business Brew with Bill Brewster like maybe a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Really good episode. Really dived into your story. I wanted to talk about and kind of focus on ETF today, but you went into kind of it was like an entrepreneurial episode about the trials and tribulations. So that was a good episode. Thanks for doing that and super in depth and really interesting to listen to.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Why don't we well, before we go on, just real quick, guys, as always, of course, I'm not a financial advisor. Everything we talk about today, this is definitely for kind of informational and educational purposes only. There's no recommendations on any investment here. Please do your own due diligence. Talk to your tax professional, finance advisor. But yeah, usual. I don't know if Wes, you need to say anything get out of the way, or if that's going to cover it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm regulated by everyone on the planet Earth. So I'll do my best to communicate as freely as possible, but in certain areas I might have to say, hey, you just can't talk about it because I don't want to piss somebody off, but I'll let you know if we get there.
Yeah, no problem. So why don't we start with, can you give us a little bit about your background just real quick and how you got into business, Alpha Architect, what do you guys do and how that all got started?
Yeah, so it's going back about 15 years now. And I like honestly, I just always wanted to start an asset management business since I was basically a kid. And so my background is, I was Wharton undergrad. I'm a Chicago finance PhD. So I was all in on kind of like the quant geek thing. And then I had a stint, I was in the military for a while. But when I came back, I basically started off as a professor. And then simultaneous, when I was starting up as a professor, I was also got cold call by a gazillionaire out of New York City. And so I was doing two things at the same time. I was kind of laying the foundation for the firm, and then I was also being a professor. And then at some point, I think it was 3 to 4 years of me being a professor, I had to make a decision like, hey, this is getting way too serious. I need to focus. And I basically resigned my professor job and then went all in on Alpha Architect. And that might have been, shoot, I don't even know, 2015, 2016. And then, we did that for a long time. Well, we still do that. And then about 5 years ago, Alpha Architect is kind of like our asset management business, like our intellectual property and our personal ideas. But then we opened up our infrastructure capabilities on the ETF side about 5 years ago. And that business is called ETF Architect. And that's where people, if they just want low cost, easy to use ETF ops to like launch your own ETF, we do that for other folks. And so now we got, like 50 funds on that platform and billions of dollars. And, a handful of those are ours at Alpha Architect. And then the rest are other people's ETFs. So
Yeah, I
that's
was
what we do
gonna
now.
ask how many, obviously Box is the one that I was kind of keen to talk about, but how many products or how many funds, strategies, types did you guys have before kind of opening up the infrastructure to allow other people start their own funds?
Yeah, so right now, I think we have 50 funds or it's some around there. But so as you can imagine, if you have 50 funds on your platform, you have everything under the sun at this point. So, we have a fund that does a lot of things, and they're not our funds, right? We're just the monkey in the background doing all the work, and then someone else is the brand and the intellectual property behind them. And then for us in particular, like Alpha Architect funds, we're pretty focused. We do like concentrated factor funds. And then we do these several derivative-based funds in collaboration with our buddies at Aaron Risk Advisors. And one of those is a tail risk fund, and then which is called Chaos is the ticker, tail risk chaos. And
Nice.
then Box obviously is also an option-based fund that's just trying to capture, treasury bill plus type returns.
So, why now for this type of product? Has there been a product like this before that, is trying to kind of emulate the
No.
T-bill risk-free rate
Yeah.
and
So I mean, the problem with this, as you can imagine, is like most people outside of option geeks like yourself, they don't even know what a box spread is. Like still today, 95% of financial professionals, if you said, "Hey, what's a box spread?" they'd be like, "I don't know what you're talking about. Is that something you buy at like a supermarket or what?" And then you can only imagine like, okay, great. We're bringing this which most people consider like a very innovative, weird, unique idea that's kind of always sat back in the shadows of prop hedge fund and option market maker dealers. We're bringing that forward into the '40 Act wrapper, which is, mutual fund ETF, SEC, the most regulated thing on the planet. So you can imagine at every step of the way, as we've been bringing this to market, like for example, in the prospectus, we're like, hey, we're using an option strategy, and we want to have no market risk disclosures in the prospectus. And you can imagine a lawyer looking at us saying, "Wait a second, you guys are doing options on the S&P 500 and things like this, and you're saying there's no market risk. Like, what planet do you live on?" And so this kind of like continuous education, continuous background, like we've been fighting this now for years. And even to this day, we have, we're trying to educate the marketplace about box spreads, and unfortunately, it's just complicated, and it's been a long road uphill, I would say.
when did Box initially launch?
So we launched it probably only about a year and 3 or 4 months ago. It was basically at the right around the beginning of last year, a year and 3 months, I guess,
And
something like that.
then what about kind of the idea, or when did you realize there was enough demand to kind of
So
warrant?
yes, yeah, so the idea was brought to us a long time ago by this guy Larry Lempert, who's a buddy of mine. He showed up to my house, long time ago, 7, 8 years ago, and they started talking about box spreads. And it wasn't really in the context of an ETF per se, but it was just like, hey, this is good for lending, borrowing. And we're like, oh, that's really cool. Especially on like the lending side, or sorry, the borrowing side. Just because, hey, I can borrow cheaper than borrowing from my prime, that's something we might want to be into. But at the time, funding rates were like 50 bips. And, most people didn't care about cash management, to include myself at the time. So we're like, all right, that's kind of awesome. We'll tinker with it, think about it, but it doesn't really seem like the greatest idea. And then I don't know, it's probably like 2 or 3 years ago. For whatever reason, we thought, well, this is, not that we're like great at predicting the market, but sometimes you get lucky. But it just seemed that, inflation or rates, like it was inevitable that we can't be in the zero interest rate world forever, especially post-COVID and post, I guess common sense. Like, I
Right.
can't time these things, but at some point, short rates are not going to be 50 basis points anymore. And so we're like, let's get rocking on this thing, right? And so what we did with the Aaron team is before that, they had this mutual fund, which is now Chaos, but and I was a personal owner of that, but I hated the taxes on the thing. And I said, hey guys, like, can we convert this over? Like, this would be great, like a tail risk product that's tax efficient in an ETF versus mutual fund. And they're like, great. So we did that. And then along with that came like, well, let's also do box right now because we're in the middle of getting married, basically. You know, let's do it all at once, right? And so that's basically what we did. And that's when the process kind of started, probably like 2 or 3 years of actually, how do we get this to market? And then obviously, you know, again, just relying on luck, which you don't want to rely on, but it happens sometimes. You know, when we finally launched it, rates were, you know, 5% or higher, which was a great time. And you know, they've been high. So we've been in a lucky time period where we launched a product where cash management was like critical and it was worthwhile for people to pay attention to.
And as you mentioned earlier, most of our audience is going to be options nerds, but
Great.
I think you do a pretty good job explaining what a box spread is. And I know it helps. This is a audio only podcast, but you gave me some nice
Yeah.
literature on box spreads or some diagrams. But if you could kind of get a high level, how you would, I don't know, explain box spreads, if you had a couple minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So, the easiest way I found to explain it is just to break the box spread into the two different legs, right? So a box spread is going to be four option positions, and two of these option positions are going to replicate a long future position in the stock. And that's going to consist of a long call and a short put at, say, a certain strike price, call it 1,000.
Right.
So those two option positions, long call, short put, let's say a strike of 1,000, is going to basically replicate a long position, right? Great. Then we have two other positions, which are going to be long put, short call, which represent a short position in the stock. And that might be at a different strike price, call it 2,000. And so intuitively, if one creates a synthetic long position in the stock, and one creates a synthetic short position in the stock, the market risk component of this trade intuitively should be canceled out, right? Because if you're
Neutralized, right?
long, yeah, if you're long the thing and short the thing, well, it can't be a lot of market risk because they just cancel each other out. And so in a box spread, what you're left with is basically a delivery of cash flow equal to the difference in the strikes. So in this case, if I synthetic long at 1,000 strike and I synthetic short at 2,000 strike, the trade will deliver $1,000 whenever the option box expires. So in 3 months, you know, we get $1,000, right? And then, you know, because markets are efficient, if someone says, hey, I'm going to deliver $1,000 to you, almost guaranteed, or at least as guaranteed as the OCC will guarantee it, I'm going to give you $1,000 3 months from now. Well, you know, you're going to be able to sell that for probably something equivalent to like a T-bill, right? Like 950, 975, what have you. You know, it's just because through arbitrage and because there's quote unquote free money, you know, people are going to compete that thing away till it gets to roughly the treasury bill equivalent rates, but just because the risk profile is very low.
And that's just purely market force dynamics, because again, you said there is, a guarantee of a cash flow or almost risk-free. And so this
Yeah.
is something that will give you a predictable cash flow at some point in time. And that therein, through just pure market dynamics, will result in the opportunity
Yes.
to earn a return similar to T-bills.
Yes, exactly. Because all you're doing effectively with the box spread is just borrowing and lending through the option markets. Because as you know, and all your audience probably knows, like part of a call, like the beauty of a call is I don't have to post all the money today, right? I could either buy a stock, but that means I got to pull all my money out of my piggy bank to go pay for the damn thing. Whereas an option, it's kind of implicit leverage, right? There's implicit borrowing in options. And so all the box trade is doing through put call parity is literally synthesizing out the implied borrow lending rates embedded in the option markets. And so in the box is just a way to just focus on that very particular component of the option market, which is huge because a lot of people are involved, obviously, in option market making.
And you mentioned just now the clearing through the OCC. Can you explain what that is or why
Yep.
is that important?
Yeah, so that's important because basically in the old days, let's say that you're running an option dealer, I'm running an option dealer, and let's say you need to borrow to in a book today, you need to borrow $1 billion, and I have $1 billion of excess cash, right? We'll meet in the middle and say, like, hey, David, I'll tell you what, I'll sell you the box, and you basically get your $1 billion, and then I'm gonna make like a little return on that. And that's great. The problem is that if I do that over the counter, like what if you're a deadbeat and you're not going to pay me? Now I got credit risk involved and counterparty risk. And so what the OCC, which is Option Clearing Corporation, did, and DTCC is the similar for like stocks and bond clearinghouse, is they say this is kind of crazy that everyone has to deal with the other counterparty risk. That's just too risky if you're doing over the counter. Let's centralize clearing, make everyone kind of self-insure everyone else through a clearing corporation, and then everyone's better off because now it doesn't matter if you're a deadbeat credit or not, because the option clearing corporation will guarantee the payments of those options. So now you just took away all my counterparty risk, all the credit risk considerations. And that's critically important because if I'm borrowing and lending money, I want to have good counterparties, right? I want a bank. I want a AAA institution. I want someone who's going to be around to give me my money back in a month or two. And so the OCC kind of just takes that risk off the table, which allows the box lending market and the option markets in general to flourish
And
because people don't have to worry about other people on the other side of the trade.
how do they do that? Like, are they a bank? Are they backed by a bank or
No, so
how?
they basically every major banking institution and member of OCC is part of OCC and they're funding it all. And so, for example, let's say, and it's also backed by the Fed, it's a SIFMU, and implicitly it's backed by the government because if a clearing corporation goes down, there's a
Right.
lot of problems with trust and confidence and what do they call that? Dominoes falling. So there's a lot of reasons why, there's nothing's guaranteed, obviously, but there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want OCC to go down. And I can't remember. I think in 87 crash, there might have been some potentially failed trades, and then OCC had to come in and like recoup it. And then they basically charged the member firms, right? So it's Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, basically every large broker dealer bank institution on the planet is going to be a member of OCC. And what happens is let's say someone goes bust on a trade, they're going to be like, all right, everyone else, we're going to put the can out, like everyone put their 50 cents in because we need to deal with the fact that, whatever, Bear Stearns over here or something just, shit the bed. That's a general concept. I'm not like a deep expert in like clearing custody and like the deep mechanics of exactly how they do it, but that's the idea. It's basically a bunch of group firms are kind of self-insuring everyone else, and there's kind of an implicit government guarantee just for functions of markets and the Fed, just so everyone has confidence that the systems are working.
So, just at face value,
Yeah.
as you said, due to market dynamics, the box spreads allow you to earn T-bill like returns.
Yeah.
So why not just buy T-bills? What's kind of like
Yeah,
the
yeah.
fast
So
elevator pitch?
yeah. So there's a few reasons. So T it actually you earn more than T-bill returns. Like there's a bunch of great papers. There's a paper by a bunch, actually, I think one of the Fed Reserve researchers is on there, and Wharton Prof's on there, where it's called risk-free rates. It was published in the Journal of Financial Economics. And they do a very good job of showing like the time series dynamics of box spreads relative to equivalent duration T-bills. And what you'll notice is historically and throughout time, not all the time, but vast majority of the time, box spreads for equivalent duration, like let's say you got a 3-month duration T-bill that's, you get 5%, the box spread will generally clear at like 25 to 50 bips above T-bill. So there's arguably an opportunity to earn extra return for equivalent risk and duration. in the box spread. So that's one reason to do it. You just can earn higher returns for
That's
similar
pretty
risk.
25 to 50 annualized, right? That's not trivial.
No, not in a funding market. It's not trivial at all. And so what a lot of people say is like, well, how is that possible? That sounds like an arbitrage. And it kind of is an arbitrage, but not really, because the only credible counterparty that could basically borrow at Fed funds rates would be like a bank, maybe. But a bank has to earn a return on their capital. And are they going to go out there and be like, oh, you know, this thing's making Fed funds plus, say, 25, 50 bips. I'm going to go borrow from the Fed, you know, do box spread arbitrage. Probably not, because they also have like capital requirements. And I doubt that the Fed is going to give you equivalent collateral benefits with a box spread versus a treasury bill. And actually, that paper talks about convenience yield, because there's something special about treasuries, because the government kind of gives you a hookup. And they allow you to lever up your balance sheet a lot more if you're holding like no kidding treasury bills versus a box spread. So a bank is not going to naturally arbitrage a box spread, even though they're the only ones that really could. The next operators that could do this would be like huge broker dealers and market makers, like think Citadel, Jane Street, Susquehanna, what have you. They're usually borrowing money from a bank, like a prime brokerage, like Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan. And JP Morgan is usually charging them a funding spread, right? They'll be like, hey, you want to borrow from us? You're going to pay Fed funds plus, say, 30 bips or 35 bips. You know, and if you have money on your balances, you know, we're going to give you Fed funds minus 30 bips. And so if I'm Susquehanna and I'm like, crap, I need to borrow money from JP Morgan. They're charging me Fed funds plus 30. I could also go buy a box spread from David, and he's only charging me, you know, basically Fed funds plus 25. Well, I could save 5 bips. I'll go borrow directly from him. So there's always this kind of natural wedge. It's not alpha. It's just like a frictional arbitrage spread in the box spread, and that's why they tend to be 25 to 50 bips, because they're. It's just an alternative, it's direct consumer lending source effectively. And so that's why that spread will probably always be there, you know, in some form or fashion for a long time, would be my guess.
Got it. And then as far as the, trading these, and you guys are doing SPX, right? Basically index European
Yeah,
style index
we
options.
do everything European style. And we trade SPX, we trade SPY, we trade individual stocks, and there's a lot of reasons why we do that. It's a lot of it's kind of tax related, but
All
yeah.
within box, you trade
Yes,
basically. Okay.
we're getting box spreads, and we want to trade them in different markets to maintain diversification, operational capabilities. But you know, as you probably know, and your listeners know, like a box spread is a box spread. I could create a box spread in any asset really. The key is we want to make sure it's European, and we generally only do European flex just so they're cleared with OCC, and we don't want any sort of like early exercise risk, obviously. But we generally trade a gamut of these, and we try to focus in SP 500 related instruments just because there's so much scale, liquidity, and volume there. But we do trade other markets as well.
And so given let's take SPX for example. With the tax treatment, even without getting to like kind of under the hood ETF specific stuff, they're treated differently tax wise than T-bills, right? There's some differences as far as
Yes.
like
And
state level tax.
so yeah, this is the part of the show where I have to pull up my I'm regulated by everyone trump card. And obviously we don't give tax advice, and every comment I'm about to make has nothing to do with box.
Sure, these
I'm
are
just
it's
going to
like
talk
just
about
facts,
box
basically.
spreads, yeah, just facts. So in general, and there's, you know, people argue about this all the time, by the way. Box spreads, especially if you did those on a like SPX, for example, SPX is considered an equity index option. They generally fall under Section 1256, which is the futures taxation, right? So 60% cap gains, 40% short-term gains. Most people that do box spreads, just you know, in your account, and all brokers that I know of on the 1099 report box spread gains as 1256 6040 capital gains. That's just an empirical fact and observation.
Right.
Now, should they be taxed like that is something you'd want to talk to your lawyer about just to confirm. But general consensus is if I just do a box spread in my personal account and I do it on SPX, I'm going to get 60/40 capital gains treatment. And that's how the brokers are going to report it on the 1099 as well, at least in our experience.
Okay. And that's basically different than how you get taxed on your interest from the T-bills.
Yes. And then treasury bill interest is generally taxed as income. And one nice thing about treasury bills, as in contrast to a box spread, is a box spread, if you take for fact that it's taxed 1256, or even if it wasn't, it's not, it will be subject to state taxes. So for example, mm-hmm. if I live in California and I'm already paying the feds, and now I got, you know, California noose around my neck. You know, if you do a box trade, even if it's treated as income, it's worse than a T-bill, because the T-bill, you're only going to have to pay the federal tax. It's not subject to the California state tax. And so the box spread benefit over treasury bills on the return would have to be pretty high to overcome, I think it's 13.3 or something, high marginal bracket there. It, you know, so it's something you definitely want to think about when you're doing these, and it's not like a panacea is what I would say.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, there's people have, you know, depending on where you live, depending on your tax situation, there's yes. different considerations, right? So, you know, you yep. mentioned what boxes plus potentially a higher yield, but then yep. there's different tax treatments. Anything yes. else that comes off the top of your head as far as just differences that people might want to?
No, that's the key thing. One of the things that I find very interesting about that paper, that risk-free rates paper, is their whole argument is it's called convenience yield, where they actually say, like, listen, the treasury bill is not the true risk-free rate. The box spread is. Because the box spread is not subject to government shutdowns, right? Like last year, like his last Q1 or whatever, like if I have a T-bill that's about to expire and the government shut down, it's not a 3-month T-bill, it's now a 4-month T-bill. Like that's a weird risk that's kind of tied to treasury bills.
Yeah.
The other issue is that like the US government forces through incentives treasury bills down the throat of banks and insurance companies because they get benefits on their equity capital. So if you have huge natural buyers and you may have incentives to make them pump up the jam, and you know you can legally force them to do it, they may push prices above, you know, in this, or sorry, the yields implicitly, like the price is going up, but like the yields implicitly might be earning less than the true risk-free rate. And that's kind of like one of the arguments that this paper makes. And I think what's interesting is a box spread is there's no convenience yield. It's not like the government forces insurance companies or banks to buy them, right? It's just kind of the true free floating time value of money with arguably like a really tight counterparty in OCC. And so it reflects like real risk-free rates you should be earning nominally, at least on your capital. Whereas treasury bill is honestly, it's unclear that it's fairly priced all the time because you know, you can have natural buyers that pay too much for it.
On that note, I seem to remember last year when we were kind of had a looming government shutdown again, there were some kind of distortions on the, the yield curve.
100%, especially in the short end, because people are like, shit, I'm not going to get paid. My duration risk was 3 months. Now it's 4 months or 5 months. And so you had this crazy like risk premia in T-bills versus yeah. the box. Like the box actually on the same duration, like it was actually the first time where it actually went flat because it wasn't apples to apples. Like the 3-month T-bill or the 1-month T-bill or whatever it is was not equivalent to the 1-month box because you weren't getting paid a month from now. You might get, you know, so it was weird because on paper, but the market's smart. The market always, is disciplined and it highlights in prices. Yes, that is not the same. That's why all of a sudden the quote unquote box spread is gone because the durations are not matched actually, even though on paper it looks like they are. So it's very interesting time last year, for sure.
So I think, even a couple of weeks ago when you were on with Bill, you mentioned, I mean, you guys crossed over $1 billion AUM, right? That's some, I think I'm looking at your
Yeah,
site.
the box ETF, I think it's like, I can't even keep track of it, but it's like 1.7 or 1.8 billion or something crazy.
And so you sort of addressed what I'm about to ask, but I was thinking just like with so much AUM, like liquidity, you know, is that a concern? Is there some kind of, you know, how do you view that? And I know trading multiple products helps, but again, I just anything you want to mention on
So
that?
what I would say is there's always liquidity issue in anything you trade at some level, right? So as long as Box, in our opinion, grows at even at the current rates, like it doesn't go from like 2 billion to like 20 overnight, I think the marketplace, as it adapts to like, hey, here's a large natural lending counterparty that is an alternative to like primes and other borrowing sources, it's going to actually open up more and more liquidity because bigger and bigger players are like, oh, wow, I can go clear a $1 billion box with these guys. And they have all the liquidity on the lending side because they herded all the cats in the marketplace.
Right.
So I think actually, as long as we don't go like from 1 to 100, which I don't know why we would, because it's not like we're marketing. You know, we're not iShares or something. I imagine it's kind of like a slow drip torture where people learn about it. They're like, oh, this is cool, whatever. So our plan is kind of like grow responsibly and also inform and educate the marketplace as we continue to grow. And as we get bigger, we get more counterparties, more market makers involvement, and those keep expanding the liquidity. Now, let's say we got, I'm just making this up, I'm not saying this is even possible, but let's say we got to like, I don't know, 200 or 300 billion or something crazy, like the biggest cash manager product that ever existed in the ETF, which I don't anticipate. I am sure at some limit, there's got to be a liquidity constraint at some scale, just because naturally markets always have supply demand issues, but I just don't know what that is. And then at some point, if you just get too big, like, worst case in our prospectus, even, we can own T-bills, right? Like if for whatever reason the box market starts offering us less than T-bills, we'll be like, well, why would we do a box at negative value? That's stupid. We'll just go buy T-bills. And then until the market gets better, we're not going to lose money on purpose. Like, I use this for my own, personal money too. Like, why would I want to shoot myself in the foot? But I just don't really think that we're anywhere even close, and it's very hard to predict at those scales and those dynamics. There's usually going to be a market equilibrium, and I think intuitively the macro equilibrium on box spreads is they're going to be Fed funds plus something. It's under the funding rates at the primes because, again, if I can borrow 10 billion or 20 billion at JP Morgan at Fed funds plus 30, and these boneheads are doing it at Fed funds plus 29 or 28, like bips matter when you're talking about huge scale. So that demand market or that funding market, I think, is very elastic to price. And so to the extent we had to drop, like say, hey, we're hitting boxes at 30 to 40 bips. Okay, now we got more money than we ever knew what to do with. We're going to have to start buying boxes at, Fed funds plus 25, but that sucks because I'd rather do it at 40. But hey, now we're going to attract, we can take on 100 billion more in liquidity. Those trade-offs might make sense. But like I said, this is all hypothetical. We're not even in the zip code of that right now.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I've been buying a few shares here and there, and this is the bid-ask spread is super. It's literally a penny wide. So as far as ETF
Exactly.
goes,
It's
it's very
super
liquid.
liquid product, and we designed it to be like that because it's a cash funding vehicle. You don't want to spread on a cash management product because that'd be crazy.
So I see on your site kind of. You focus on a yield kind of, you know, greater than 1 to 3 month T-bills. That's sort of like the comparison you make. And again, is that just purely based on market dynamics, or is there something where you could compare to longer term, or actually
yeah.
longer term compared to longer term rates, and or the boxes you actually do, mm-hmm. are they focused in that 1 to 3 month range, or do you yes. do kind of a different tenors? And
no. Yeah. So the first product we wanted to launch, we just wanted to do like the simplest, easiest, most liquid market. And that's generally like 1 to 3 month. And there's also like competitive ETFs out there where they're literally 1 to 3 month. And it's just nice to have like a direct comparable, right? Like, hey, we're going to do 1 to 3 month. You can go look at other guys that do 1 to 3 month, and let's just do a horse race every day. And is what it is, right? The results will be there. So it just made it easy. And there's just a big market of buyers and sellers in that space. Now, we could have also said, hey, we're going to do 0 to 1 year to like broaden that out. And you know, we're in the middle of like contemplating other products, but that's just what we decided on Box as the initial, because it was the easiest and thing for people to understand. There's a ton of liquidity there, but obviously you can expand the concept to a lot of different durations. It's just that's not what we do in Box, the 1 to 3 month, just because we had to follow the prospectus, obviously.
Yeah, but possibly down the road, like a 1 year.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, and there's other techniques, like it's, you know, beyond scope here, but you know, we can do a lot of things, and we're very creative and, you know, good at financial engineering. But if you're just talking about pure boxes, you know, usually the box market liquidity, you can get boxes obviously out to a year, out to 2 years, but that's not really where a lot of liquidity is. It's really in the shorter end because people are using it as an alternative, like borrow lending source. And it's usually for short-term debit credit balances. And it's just, there's not a huge market out in like the longer duration. At least for an ETF product, right? If you're just an individual and you're like, hey, you know, I want two year duration box, you know, it's not like billions of dollars. I'm sure you could go coordinate to get that trade done, but it's a little bit harder in an ETF where we have a lot more scale, and you know, we're trying to target a duration. We want to make sure there's like a decent market size there.
And you mentioned it's 100% European style.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Exactly. You mentioned like, even single names, but I was wondering like,
even on single names, because we're institutional level, we can actually go to SIBO. We want to get everything flex, and European flex, so they clear through OCC. Because most individuals, I don't know, like, I don't think you can do that.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about.
Yeah, we don't technically in our prospectus, we allow ourselves to do American, because you can imagine like some doomsday, or I don't even know, but there's got to be some scenario we'd want that ability. But like, as we've been implemented in for a foreseeable future, like we only do European, because I don't even want early exercise risk on the table, because what's the point? And we don't have to. We just do Euroflex on everything.
So I don't think this is going to happen anytime soon, but have you thought about like, what if rates go down again? Or is that something you kind of just running with things and, you know, see where things go? But do you think
about
that?
Of course. Yeah. So, I mean, as you'd expect, if rates go down, which is certainly plausible if we, you know, have a recession or God knows what, just like rates could go up, you know, obviously cash management vehicles are going to be way less attractive, because at the margin, who cares? You know, like in the old days, not that long ago, like you would go to do a pitch and like, okay, Schwab, I'm getting paid 25 bips. Your fund's making me 45 bips. Like, who cares? Like, I'm, you know, it's just, it just doesn't, people don't think about it, and it just doesn't matter. And so if we went back to that world, obviously box and anything like it, it's just, there's less demand and less interest in those products. It just is what it is. And then obviously if they go up, like if I can't predict the future here, but like, let's say rates go to like 8, 9, 10%, you know, I imagine cash management products will get even more popular, but right. That's just something that will, you know, I can never say never, but we're not like iShares. Like when we launch products, you know, generally we put our personal money into them. We think a lot about them, and we don't close anything ever. Because why would you launch a product if you thought you were going to close it someday? And so we're here for the long game. And it might be dry. We might have a dry season for a long time if rates go to 50 bips, but I don't think, at least as long as they let me stay in charge of the popsicle stand, I like to keep products alive because, kind of our investors rely on us running them for the long game. So we keep them operating.
Makes sense. Okay. And so before we wind down, again, I know a lot of our guys were asking and want to know about the whole thing with the tax efficiencies. I know you got to punt a
Yeah.
little bit because of, kind of
Well, I
regulations.
will say this. If you read articles about this, just be cognizant that all the facts that they rely on are not facts that where they called us up and asked us how we did it. They're relying on public sources that are factually incorrect. And so all I'd highlight is that whenever analysis is conducted, even if it's great analysis, but it's based on, third parties that don't actually operate the business or run the products or what have you, that analysis is great given the facts presented, but what if the facts are just incorrect? So
Yeah,
that's all I would say on that component.
certainly, and again, like you mentioned, some of that may be kind of secret sauce, right? No one wants you to kind of divulge everything.
Yes.
But I was thinking, just kind of from a high level, so people can sort of get a sense. Like, can you go
Sure.
over generally just ETFs in general? Like, people know they're
Yeah.
tax
So,
efficient vehicles, and you mentioned, for example, the term in-kind treatment. Like, what does that mean, and
yes.
how might
So,
an ETF do some
yeah,
tricks too?
exactly. So, broad ETFs, like the reason why option related funds and equity related funds and tactical funds that kind of trade other ETFs generally have de minimis capital gains distribution is because of this very special rule in the RIC statutes, the regulated investment company statute, which all ETFs and mutual funds, unfortunately, mutual funds can't use this just the way they're set up, but ETFs can. There's this rule. It's called 852 B6. So 852 is the section of the code, B6 is the area of the code, which basically says that in-kind trades or balance rebalancing through these in-kind transactions are non-taxable. So ETFs obviously use this to great extent where, and this also applies to options. So Cboe filed with the SEC to get options to be in-kind tradable as well. So I'll just do a simple example, right? So let's say like you have Microsoft, you buy it at a dollar, or you buy a call option on Microsoft for a dollar. And then, Microsoft goes up 100 times. So now it's at $100, or the option's up 10,000 times. As all everyone on this call probably unfortunately knows, the only way to exit that is to pay a massive tax bill, right? Because you got to sell the damn thing to get the cash or to get to the next security. In an ETF, to the extent that you're like, you know what? I don't want to own Microsoft anymore because I think it's overvalued, but I want to do this tax efficiently. What you would do is you would create baskets where you'd create a redemption basket that consists of the Microsoft shares or the options on Microsoft, whatever it is. And whenever that creation or that redemption basket is redeemed from the fund, what you're doing is we're delivering the shares to fulfill the redeem. That's an in-kind transaction that's non-taxable. So essentially, it's kind of complicated. There's a lot of like details on this, but ETFs have this very unique ability to basically, it's kind of like a laundromat for capital gains, I guess you'd call it, where you could do transactions, trade options, trades equities, tactically shift between ETFs. And for the most part, those investment decisions are not going to carry tax consequences immediately. Now, to be clear, it's not a tax dodge, it's a tax deferral.
Right.
Right, because all the NAV of the ETF is going to keep going higher and higher and higher, and eventually you're going to have a massive tax bill, and you're going to have to like pay the man at some point. But at least you get to choose when you pay the man. You're not forced to do it along the way or based on like the portfolio manager's decisions, which I actually frankly think is a fair way to do it because a lot of times in funds, like if a big investor gets out of a fund, they can actually impose tax liability on you, even though you didn't buy or sell anything, right? That doesn't make any sense to me. So I think an ETF is just a fair way where the end buyer or seller of the ETF, they pick their tax poison when they want it, but it doesn't affect other shareholders in the ETF, which I think is a good thing from a public policy perspective, frankly.
And you said this takes advantage of some regulations specific to ETFs, right? Because I remember...
It's the regulated investment company. So an ETF is a C corp, as is a mutual fund, by the way. And so C corps, as you probably know, are subject to double taxation. However, the way you get around that is you qualify as a RIC, a regulated investment company. And Section 852 actually outlines specifically if you're a C corp and if you want to qualify as a RIC, what do you have to do? And basically what it involves is it's like an investment company. You know, you got to distribute not all, but pretty much all your capital gains, dividends, and income every year. There's diversification requirements, blah, blah, blah. And in that statute is this very specific line, 852B6, which is about basket treatment. And it just says it's non-taxable, which is great.
Yeah, this reminds me, you had an interesting segment on that episode, Bill, and for, you know, if there's family offices or high net worth who have some legacy investments, which, you know, at low basis and, you know, they don't want the exposure, they want to transition out of it.
Yes.
The ETF is sort of a vehicle to.
Yeah,
to
that's a whole nother section of the code we also deal with. That's like how to get into an ETF wrapper tax-free. That's called Section 351. But generic ETF tax efficiency, vast majority of it is driven by this very, very unique statute tied to the RICs, which gives ETFs this massive tax advantage over, I mean, frankly, pretty much everything. There's also some stuff in like insurance people can do, but now it's like super high fee, totally opaque, you know. The ETF is nice, man. It democratizes transparency, low cost, and tax efficiency, which, I mean, I don't know why public policy wouldn't want to promote that, you know? I mean, like, why wouldn't you? I mean, the government's crazy, so they might like other things. But, like, intuitively, you would think if I could promote something that's, like, just, you know, transparent, low cost, and tax efficient for everybody, not just rich people, I would promote the hell out of that public policy, and I would get rid of the rich only people tax schemes, you know, like all the other, like the real estate deals, insurance deals, structured product deals, like all the, you know, the business loopholes, like it's just nuts.
For sure. So with that said, Wes, you know, where can people find out more about, Box, about Alpha Architect, or if they want to follow you?
Yep. So on Twitter, I guess X, they call it now. It's just, you know, Alpha Architect. I still call it Twitter just because they can't get out of my brain. But just Alpha Architect on there. And then our, what, you know, our main website is alphaarchitect.com. And then if you want to launch your own ETF or figure out how that works, etfarchitect.com.
Yeah, maybe one of these days we'll have another call, because it's, again, just want to repeat for those who come on late. Yeah, you've always been super generous, you know, with your time. And literally, I messaged you and we had a conversation about, you know, you walked me through ins and outs, the costs and everything. So,
yeah. And it's, by the way, when you're ready, options in the ETF wrapper have gotten a lot easier and lower cost to manage. And I just walked it through, like, the tax potential benefits. So,
right.
I mean, I think you're going to see a huge run in derivatives in ETFs. You're already seeing it with Innovator, Defined Outcome, all the buffer type funds. Like iShares actually just filed for a bunch. I think this is going to become a huge market as people kind of wake up to the fact that, hey, if I'm doing an option-based strategy, And I'm talking about taxable money, the ETF is just a much more scalable, low cost, transparent, tax efficient way to do that advice.
That's super cool. There's been, you know, I've noticed kind of the proliferation of all these different products now, and just generally the increased access for retail to alternative and you know, institutional grade exposure. And, you know, that's why I have guests like you on here. So I think it's sort of like, I call it the golden age of retail. I feel like that's what we're
it's crazy
going into, if not already.
Yes. And I talked to hedge fund people all the time, like wanting to get in a wrapper. Like I feel like everyone is just moving towards low cost, tax efficient, transparent, which is the ETF. And yeah, if you're a retail investor, like you literally get all the same benefits as a billionaire, right? Because billionaires get really low costs because we say, hey, I'm a billionaire, I'll give you 250 million to manage, and you'll be like, but I want half the fees. Like, most of us would say, yes, sir, sign me up, right? They also like transparency. Well, they do it in a managed account. Like if billionaires don't invest in hedge funds typically, they're like, nope, I'll do it in my managed account. So they get transparency, they see it. And then billionaires also have access to all these whack job tax schemes that rich guys have. So it's tax efficient. Well, ETF gives all those benefits to like someone with $25 in a Schwab account now. It's crazy. I
For
think it's
sure.
great.
Yep,
That's,
definitely.
yeah. I mean, Vanguard kind of, they're the ones that pushed it. So I'll give them all the credit. But we're vanguardizing everything, it seems, for the most part. It's just where the world's heading.
Well, Wes, it's been a real pleasure. I know you got another call, but appreciate all the time you spent in the past and now, and congrats on all the success with Box, and looking forward to see what else you guys come up with.
Yeah, you got it. Appreciate you having me on. And yeah, reach out anytime. Happy to help.
All right. Have a good day.